This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said Saturday that military operations in northern Tigray region have been completed. This news came shortly after he announced that federal troops had seized full control of the regional capital, Mekele. There was no immediate comment from the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF, forces, who have been fighting Ethiopian troops for the past 3 weeks in a conflict that has affected neighboring countries in the Horn of Africa. Abiy said police were searching for the TPLF leaders to bring them to justice. Claims from all sides, though, are difficult to verify since phone and internet links to the region have been down and access has been tightly controlled since the fighting started. Boko Haram fighters killed at least 43 farm workers and injured six as they worked in rice fields in northeast Nigeria Saturday. This is what anti-jihadist militia told the AFP news agency. The victims were laborers from Sokoto State in northwest Nigeria, roughly 1,000 kilometers away. They had traveled to the northeast to find work, according to the militiamen. Boko Haram and its Islamic State rival have increasingly targeted loggers, herders, and fishermen in their violent campaign, accusing them of spying and passing information to the military and the local militia fighting them. At least 36,000 people have been killed in the jihadist conflict, which has displaced around 2 million since 2009. An Israeli cabinet minister close to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Saturday he had no clue who was behind the killing of an Iranian nuclear scientist in Tehran. Iran is blaming the Friday assassination of its top nuclear scientist on Israel. For more on this story, please visit our website at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Pope Francis created 13 new cardinals on Saturday, putting his personal stamp on the body that will one day choose his successor. It was a diverse group whose members hail from Italy, Malta, the Philippines, Chile, Brunei, Mexico, and the United States. The 72-year-old Archbishop of Washington, D.C. in the United States, his name is Wilton Gregory. He was made the first African-American cardinal. Indian Kashmir on Saturday held its first direct election since the government stripped its semi-autonomy last year. On high alert for attacks by separatist militants, dozens of police and paramilitaries with machine guns watched outside each voting station while army patrols toured the streets. The Himalayan region, which is also claimed by Pakistan, has been under heavy security since the ruling Hindu nationalist government imposed direct rule in August of 2019. But officials said nearly 52% of the 700,000 eligible voters cast ballots during the first of the 8 days of polling, braving the security, coronavirus fears, and snow-covered terrain to elect local council members. Results are expected on December 22nd. While the councils have only limited powers, several Kashmir political parties, including the influential PDP, formed an alliance to use the election to campaign for the restoration of the region's political autonomy. Kashmir has been divided between India and Pakistan since their bitter split at independence in 1947. Both claimed the territory in full. Islamic State-linked extremists killed four people in a remote Christian community on the Indonesian island of Sulawesi, authorities said on Saturday. One victim was beheaded and another burned to death. The attackers ambushed a village in central Sulawesi province Friday morning, killing several residents and torching half a dozen homes, including one used for regular prayers and services, police said. No arrests had yet been made, and the motive for the attack was not immediately clear. But authorities pointed the finger at the Sulawesi-based East Indonesia Mujahideen, or MIT, one of dozens of radical groups across the Southeast Asian island chain that have pledged alliance to IS. Indonesia, the world's biggest Muslim-majority nation, has long wrestled with Islamist militancy and terror attacks, while central Sulawesi has seen intermittent violence between Christians and Muslims for decades. If confirmed to be the work of MIT, Friday's killings would be its first significant attack since the organization's leader was killed 4 years ago by Indonesia's elite anti-terror squad.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Emily Tamkin, U.S. Editor for the New Statesman, Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times, and our moderator is Dan Revive, columnist for Newsday.
Welcome to Washington, D.C., a capital city in transition. President Donald Trump has continued to claim there was fraud, there was cheating, there were abuses in the American election on November 3rd, but this past Monday agreed with the announcement by one of his government agencies that Joe Biden can begin the transition. Biden then named key officials for his administration, which is scheduled to begin with Inauguration Day, when he's to be sworn in as president, January 20th. Let's turn to our panel. President Trump did not concede that he lost the election, but he's not standing in the way of what's often called here a peaceful transition of power. Emily Tamkin?
Right. I interviewed Lawrence Douglas, who wrote the book Will He Go, about whether or not Trump would leave the White House a while ago. And he put forth a theory that I think we're seeing play out now, which is that Trump would not admit to defeat, but he would submit to defeat, right? So in other words, he'll never say that he lost the election, but will eventually allow the wheels to turn such that Joe Biden is able to be inaugurated and go into the White House. We should say that the reason that he's submitting is that his legal challenges and reported pressure on lawmakers to flip electors. You know, in some ways, this is kind of the best case scenario given the players involved in this drama. You know, there are risks to a truncated transition. There are national security risks. Given that we're in a pandemic, the Biden team sort of needs as much information as they can have about the pandemic, about potential vaccine distribution as quickly as they can. So we're able to move ahead there now. The danger still that remains with the president submitting to but not admitting to defeat is that there are and will continue to be millions of people who don't believe that Joe Biden is the legitimate president because their choice is still telling them that he won and that this wasn't free and that this wasn't fair. And we'll have to see whether or not that does indeed do lasting damage to our democracy and our processes and our institutions. But this is not the worst thing that could happen. But that doubt that his supporters will carry forward, I think that will remain if the president continues to not admit that he lost.
Well, public opinion surveys indicated that most Republicans think there was cheating. So as you say, Emily, Republicans may feel that the outcome of the election, that the Joe Biden administration are not legitimate, and that could be a shadow over everything. Josh Glancy, when you write about this for your British newspaper, The Sunday Times, are you writing about this as kind of a reflection of Donald Trump's personality, that he can't accept that he lost something, or in fact a political play where Trump seriously wants to run again in the year 2024?
I think you can view the two as combined to some extent. I've never quite bought the idea that Trump will run again, although who knows? He's an unpredictable character. But the presidency takes a physical and emotional toll on anyone. And the idea of revving back up to do it again at 78, I find very unlikely, although he may enjoy the speculation. I do think in terms of the shadow cast over the presidency, we did see something similar happen to Donald Trump's presidency, which was widely considered illegitimate by many Democrats, including his opponent, Hillary Clinton, primarily because of Russian interference. And the two stories are not the same. There was significant Russian interference in the 2016 election. There does not seem to be any significant evidence of electoral fraud in 2020. But nonetheless, Trump's presidency was dogged by often overblown allegations of conspiracy and collusion that made his first two or three years, it massively impacted how effective he could be as president. We should hope that that doesn't happen to Biden. And I think the fact that there is so little foundation for Trump to go on means that really only the rump of the most diehard Trump supporters will view Biden as illegitimate by the time he occupies the White House and beyond.
Perhaps at the core of the feeling or the claim by Donald Trump, by other Republicans, that there was probably some kind of cheating and there were abuses, is that there were so many votes that were not cast in the old-fashioned way. On election day, people standing in line, going into a voting booth and then using some kind of machine to vote. But instead, they submitted their votes on paper, sometimes mailing them in, sometimes delivering them. And that, of course, was because of COVID-19, the coronavirus, where many Americans were afraid to gather together on election day. Now, the result was a record number of votes. We see a record 80 million votes for Joe Biden, the Democrat, while the Republican president got nearly 74 million votes, also a record more than any loser in a U.S. election, a gap of more than 6 million votes. And in the electoral votes, where you add them up state by state, and to win, a candidate needs 270, we see 306 for Joe Biden. Now, Donald Trump did continue to tell his lawyers to challenge the count and to challenge what he considered to be fraud in states such as Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Georgia. But again and again, those claims were rejected by state and federal judges. It still brings us back to the question, Emily, whether you believe that Donald Trump is just trying to create a narrative that he was cheated and then he goes away forever, or whether there's a real chance he'll run again.
I don't know whether or not he'll run again, but I don't think that he's going to go away forever. I think that he just occupies such a large space in our political conscious, and maybe that will kind of decrease with time. But he has, not only does he have such a loyal following in terms of voters, but there are politicians now who are coming up who are modeling themselves after him in some ways. And so I think that the cliche is kind of like Trump is gone, but Trumpism remains. But I think Trump himself, though he will not be in the White House, will still continue to at least try to demand our attention.
Even during the couple of weeks when President Trump refused to concede that he lost the election and was blocking the process of letting the incoming administration have access to government funds and government information, Joe Biden, the winner, as far as we in the news media are concerned, it seems pretty clear Joe Biden was preparing his next administration. First, I'll note that he recently celebrated his 78th birthday. That was November 20th. He certainly is doing everything to appear active, and he's working on his new team. And he unveiled, for instance, his Secretary of State, assuming that the United States Senate confirms him. It's Tony Blinken, who's been an advisor to Joe Biden for decades. During the Obama-Biden administration, Blinken worked in the White House. Then he was Deputy Secretary of State. So whether it's him or Jake Sullivan, who'll be Biden's National Security Advisor in the White House, he also worked in the Obama administration, as well as being close to former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Does that add up to any strong clues that American foreign policy will definitely be different than it's been in the 4 years of Donald Trump, Josh?
Absolutely. It will be very different in style, certainly. Biden is making exactly the choices that he was predicted to make. Everyone was expecting Blinken to get either the state job or the NSA job, the National Security Advisor job. He will be America's chief diplomat. Jake Sullivan is another longtime Biden ally. Both of these people served in the Obama administration. So there's a lot of continuity from the Obama era. But, you know, Biden is himself a very experienced foreign policy politician and has his own view of how foreign policy should be conducted. And what we're going to see is a real attempt to restore America's traditional alliances, be they with Germany, be they with Japan, be they with the EU more generally. There's going to be a lot of focus on climate change. There will be some continuity with the Trump era. I think there will be a much tougher approach to China than there was during the Obama years. I think that's a permanent shift in American foreign policy. But it'll be done very differently. With Trump, it was always big headlines and bold gambits, and we're going into a trade war, and then we're going to have summits with North Korea and all this stuff that kind of had everyone in a tizzy. Whereas I think what we're going to see from the Biden team is a much more traditional, solid approach that exists well within the traditional guardrails of American foreign policy. They want to build America's alliances as a counterpoint to China and to renew some of these relationships, particularly with, say, a country like Germany that was very unhappy with America during the Trump era, and to sort of create a kind of firewall of democracies to hem China in. And that is exactly, the thing about this Biden team is, as the saying goes in a British advert, you get exactly what you see on the tin, which is these people, we know who they are. They are part of what's called the blob, the foreign policy blob in Washington, D.C. They've all written papers. They are well known. We're very acquainted with their thinking, and we're going to get exactly what we expect from them, really.
Read the label on the tin, as you say. Hey, Emily, what about John Kerry, who served as Secretary of State under President Obama? He's rejoining the government as a special envoy on climate issues. And climate, of course, is a big issue around the world. It was noted, of course, that one of the first things President Trump did was have the United States quit the Paris Climate Change Accords. Of course, the U.S. is heading back in, Emily.
Absolutely. And not only is John Kerry going to be the special envoy for climate change, but he will be participating in the National Security Council, which means that this will be the first time ever that there's been a person sitting at the council, going to those meetings, whose whole portfolio is climate change, which I think is significant and suggests that the Biden administration understands that they have to take the climate crisis seriously. What I will say is that foreign policy, I think, is one of the places to watch for tensions, maybe is the word, between the progressive wing of the Democratic Party and the Biden administration. Yes, Kerry is there. Yes, he's going to be dealing with climate change. Yes, they have this person on the NSC. Yes, they're rejoining Paris. But the progressive wing of the party thinks that Kerry's too corporate in dealing with climate change. It's too, that there's too much focus on getting Republicans on board. So I think that we can expect to see some potential, if not clashes, then heated debates there.
Divisions among Democrats. We'll have more on the change of administration, which now seems certain on January 20th here in Washington, D.C., how the place of the U.S. in the world may change and other divisions in U.S. politics. More after this brief break.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Emily Tamkin, U.S. Editor for the New Statesman. Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times, and our moderator, Dan Revive, columnist for Newsday.
We've been talking about how in the days before the major American holiday, Thanksgiving, which was this past Thursday, the president-elect, Joe Biden, revealed some of his choices for top national security jobs. Biden had the officials that he hopes will be with him. Many of them require U.S. Senate confirmation. On stage, also his future vice president, Senator Kamala Harris. This was in Biden's hometown, Wilmington, Delaware, this past Tuesday. Biden let each woman and man give a short speech. Everyone wore a mask because of the coronavirus, of course, and kept at least 6 feet or 2 meters away from each other, taking off the mask at the podium in the middle only when it was his or her turn to speak. So, Josh Glancy, what did you think of the choreography of that piece of political theater?
It's in line with everything we've seen from Biden so far, which is a lot of very visible pandemic precaution and sign that they are serious, competent, grave people who understand the moment that America finds itself in, that the world finds itself in. And also this idea that we've touched on before, this is in many ways a restorationist administration. And these are, quote unquote, serious people with a lot of experience in American public life, where they want America to go in the future. And they are also Biden's family. I mean, Biden is a family man first and foremost. He talks about this a lot during the campaign and throughout his career and how much he cares about, you know, and the tragedies he's faced in his personal family, how close he is to his son and his children he lost. These advisors are also, he's framing them as family. So Blinken and Sullivan, who we've talked about, people who've been with him for over a decade, well over a decade. Kamala Harris, he's mentioned in several speeches, your family now. How that pans out, we'll see. But he's trying to create a sense of a White House that is unified, that is collegiate, and that is serious.
Emily, when it comes to the Biden style, including his claim that he's out to unite the nation, is it going to work when it comes to all those Trump voters, especially the ones who feel that the Democrats somehow cheated?
I think that there are some Trump voters who are extremely devoted to Trump, who are never going to believe that Biden's the legitimate president, who are not interested in coming together. And in fact, who voted for Trump explicitly because Trump campaigned on us not coming together, right? He ran a very divisive campaign. However, I do think that there are some people where or for whom, if Biden offers good governance, if he gets us out of this pandemic, if the vaccine is distributed well, if they get economic relief, that they will, even if they don't vote for the Democrat in 2024, will come on board to the Biden project, right? Or even just the accept that this is America for the next 4 years. I think that the more practical issue that Biden faces is whether or not he will have enough Republican colleagues in the Senate, provided the Democrats do not manage to win both seats in the runoff election in Georgia in early January, that he will have enough Republican colleagues who are interested in governing with unity. Because if he does not manage to get enough Republicans on board, it's going to be very difficult to pass some of the legislation, not even like the bold, sweeping progressive legislation that some on the left want to see, but just to get anything done, right? We've seen before what can happen when there's divided government in Washington. It will make it very difficult for legislation to come through, and people will blame Biden for that.
Now, that's a great reminder that as a result of the November 3rd election, whereas the Democrats kept a majority in the House of Representatives, it is slimmed down a little bit, but they're still in the majority. You know, by the way, you know, this past Tuesday, when Joe Biden was introducing some of his future top officials, President Trump came into the White House briefing room really just for about 1 minute. He really just wanted to claim credit for the fact that the Dow Jones Industrials Average, right, the stock market, rose to 30,000 for the first time. He called it a sacred number. So he was claiming credit, but a lot of financial experts say that investors were buying stocks because they felt relieved that the election results are clearing up and they're fine with Joe Biden. And they like the fact that Biden would be choosing Janet Yellen, an economist, former head of the Federal Reserve Board, who served during the Obama years, to be Biden's Treasury Secretary. Wall Street feels safe with her. Now, Josh, what about the reality, though, that investors and, frankly, rich people get richer as stocks go up, even while millions of Americans have lost their jobs because of COVID-19? The irony is just one of these glaring facts about American capitalism.
Yes, I mean, it's worth recording that most Americans, particularly older ones, have some investment with their 401k in the stock market. But the inequality we've seen over the pandemic has been very stark. People like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos have made tens and tens of billions of dollars, even while unemployment has hit 15% in America. And it was curious to me how little discussion there was of this rather salient fact during the election campaign. I do think there is an enormous problem with inequality in this country, but if you're on Wall Street, I guess you're not that bothered about that, and you're looking at the stability of having a very familiar character like Janet Yellen running the Treasury. You're looking at a Biden administration probably without the Senate, although we don't know, and therefore unable to do any sweeping economic change. And you're thinking, this could be a good, stable few years to make some money. And that, yeah, may well only enlarge some of the fissures of inequality that exists within American society.
Emily, another cause of optimism among many Americans is vaccines, right? Vaccines against COVID-19 have been developed by several corporations, also work at Oxford University in Great Britain. What do you think about that? I mean, Americans seem to be ready to roll up their sleeves and get the jabs, the injections, some of them maybe just 1 month from now. That seems like quite a breakthrough.
The first thing that I want to say is that, yes, it is a breakthrough. And it's very, not even as a journalist, just as a person living through this, it's comforting to know that there's a light at the end of this long and dark tunnel. However, as a journalist, I will remind that the fact that the vaccine exists will not actually of itself help people, right? It's the vaccination that will help people, which means that we need to have the vaccine distributed quickly and widely and safely. And we also need to have enough people believe that the vaccines are safe, that they should take them, that they should use them. And what I would also just add is that, yes, the vaccine is coming, but it's not here yet. And it will not be here in time, say, for the holiday season. And so people continue to take the precautions that they've been taking for the duration of this pandemic and not drop their guards just because there is a vaccine coming.
Health officials in this country were very concerned about the Thanksgiving holiday as Americans planned on getting together. Some families said, no, we'll do it on a Zoom call. Maybe we'll hang out in the backyard if it's not too rainy or too cold. But quite a few families were driving or even flying. Airports were busy again. Thanksgiving is that much of a tradition of folks getting together. So there's some concern in a few weeks we might see the result of that. Josh Glancy, reason to worry?
Yes, definitely. As Emily says, we have an end in sight, we think, to this pandemic. As our my Prime Minister Boris Johnson says, the hooves of the cavalry are to be heard over the hill, but they're not here yet. And so in many ways, this is the final push. And talking to a lot of relatives in the UK, they're saying that the UK is going to open up for 5 days over Christmas. but that will mean that they may have to close down the whole of January. Maybe that's a trade-off some people want to make after a very long, difficult year to gather with their families at Christmas. But certainly, as far as I'm concerned, I'm thinking about my first mojito in July on at a proper party with people and thinking, I'm pretty happy to hunker down for this winter to get there. And that's probably the best approach. But, you know, people are gathering. There are ways to gather. If you get tested and you quarantine, then there are reasonably safe ways to gather. The worry is that some people are just fed up with the whole thing. They have real COVID fatigue and aren't bothering with many precautions at all at this point. And that will just cause more pain and more deaths between now and mass vaccination, which will hopefully come by the middle of next year.
Not just here in the United States, but all around the world, there is what some call COVID fatigue. Not everyone has the discipline to wear the mask, to keep their distance a year, perhaps more in some places. Yeah, it's hard. I was thinking about this when it comes to foreign affairs and America's place in the world. Linda Thomas-Greenfield, who's to be nominated by Joe Biden as the ambassador to the United Nations. She's a veteran diplomat. Everyone says she, frankly, was chased out of the State Department by President Trump's people nearly 4 years ago. She said, America is back. Multilateralism is back. Diplomacy is back. And I think we're seeing reactions, for instance, in the Middle East, right? Reports came out from Israel that that country's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu last weekend made a clandestine trip to Saudi Arabia for talks with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, probably sharing their concerns that Biden won't be so tough on Iran as Trump has been. Josh, add that to the Trump plan to pull out a lot of U.S. troops from Iraq and Afghanistan before he leaves office in January. There's a shakeup in that part of the world.
There certainly is. The Middle East is probably the area where Trump foreign policy has had some of its most notable impact. They have massively changed America's approach to Iran. They pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal. They've imposed hugely tough sanctions on Iran. And they've created this anti-Iran alliance that sort of already existed, but it's really come out into the open between Israel and Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates and others. And there are concerns that Biden administration will seek to recreate some kind of nuclear agreement with Iran. Jake Sullivan, who we've discussed, the new national security advisor, was very involved in the last nuclear agreement with Iran. And so definitely the likes of Bibi Netanyahu and Mohammed bin Salman will be anxious about this. Again, I don't think we're going to see direct Obama 2.0. I don't think we're going to see another JCPOA, which was the name of the agreement. But we probably will see a bit of a realignment. And that probably is something that MBS and Bibi want to get their heads together about and make sure that they can kind of sustain some of the gains they've made over the last 4 years.
Emily, bring it on home for us, right? When the new Biden administration will claim that America is back and multilateralism is back, what impact do you think that'll have? And by the way, do American voters really care, right? They didn't vote based on foreign policy.
Right. American voters did not vote based on foreign policy. Understandably, right? If there's a pandemic and there's job losses every week and et cetera, I think, and I say this as a person who follows foreign affairs closely and writes on it and reports on it, but like it's a luxury to be able to do that. Having said that, I think that proof will be in the pudding if America's back and multilateralism is back, right? You can't just say it. That is something that you demonstrate with your policy and your action. So we will see. I think that the appointment that you were speaking of at the UN, I think that will be very heartening for career diplomats in the State Department. I do think that the Biden administration will try to re-engage in multilateral fora. I would also say that in terms of the American example of democracy and human rights, that that is in part contingent on what we do at home. And that if the Biden administration sees its domestic policy as an extension of its foreign policy and vice versa, you know, then America will be back. And actually, not even back, but at a will have earned a place that it actually previously had not.
That's all the time we have for Issues in the News. Thanks to our panelists, Emily Tamkin, U.S. editor for The New Statesman, and Josh Glancy, Washington bureau chief for the British newspaper, The Sunday Times. This program is produced here in Washington by the Voice of America. I'm Dan Revie.
Welcome to Learning English on the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Our 30-minute program is designed for people learning English. We speak slowly, using a simple style and limited vocabulary. Today on the show, we hear the American story, The Californian's Tale, by Mark Twain. Jill Robbins brings us Ask a Teacher. But first, here's a report from Brian Lynn.
Airline companies say COVID-19 vaccines may become a requirement for international travelers. The requirement could help air carriers increase international travel after worldwide slowdowns caused by the coronavirus crisis. Promising news about vaccine development has given airlines and nations hope that they may soon be able to restart suspended flights. But some countries, especially in Asia and the Pacific, do not want their hard-fought gains against the virus to disappear. Alan Joyce is head of Australia's largest airline, Qantas. He said that once a COVID-19 vaccine is widely available, his carrier will likely require passengers to use it before they leave or land in Australia. Joyce said he has been talking to officials at other airlines around the world about the possibility of creating a vaccination passport for international travelers. We are looking at changing our terms and conditions to say for international travelers that we will ask people to have the vaccination before they get on the aircraft, Joyce told Australia's Network 9 television. He said they were looking at ways to electronically confirm that people have the necessary vaccine for their planned destination. South Korea's largest airline has a similar message. Korean Air spokeswoman Jill Chung says there is a real possibility that airlines will require that passengers be vaccinated. She said that is because governments are likely to require vaccinations as a condition for lifting quarantine rules for new arrivals. While Korean Air is reviewing several possibilities, Chung said any change by the company or other airlines should be a cooperative effort with governments. This is not something for airlines to independently decide, she said. A statement from Air New Zealand agreed it is up to governments to decide when and how it is safe to reopen borders. The airline said it was continuing to work closely with government officials on the issue. Australia, South Korea, and New Zealand have all been able to successfully limit the spread of the virus. A big part of their containment efforts have centered on keeping infected people out. Australia has enforced some of the most severe border restrictions in the world since the pandemic began. It has closed its borders to most international visitors and permitted its own citizens to travel internationally only in special cases. New Zealand has also closed its borders, while South Korea has required a 2-week quarantine on all arriving passengers. Australia, with 26 million people, has reported about 900 deaths since the pandemic began, fewer than many nations its size. South Korea, with 51 million people, has reported a little over 500 deaths. And New Zealand, a nation of 5 million people, has reported just 25 deaths. I'm Brian Lynn.
Jose Feliciano is celebrating the 50th anniversary of his beloved Christmas song, Feliz Navidad, by releasing a new version. The song is still sung in English and Spanish, but many popular artists appear in the new version, including Jason Mraz, Lin-Manuel Miranda, and Shaggy. Pop musician Michael Bolton, Latin boy band CNCO, country band Big and Rich, and Mexican singer and actress Patricia Manterola are also among the 30 acts who teamed to create the new Feliz Navidad. All the artists recorded their parts separately to stay socially distant. Amazon Music released the final creation. The many artists from different backgrounds and musical genres is in keeping with Feliciano's goals for the song, past and present. The idea of Feliz Navidad was to try and unite the people, the award-winning artist said. My thought when I wrote the song was that it didn't matter what language you were singing in. The feeling of Christmas is privy to all of us. The song has only 20 words in all, 6 in Spanish and 14 in English. The 75-year-old Feliciano says that back in 1970, he never imagined it would become a holiday hit. I would have to say it fulfills a dream, he said in an interview over Zoom from his home in Connecticut. I had the dream in my mind, but that's as far as it went until I wrote Feliz Navidad. Feliciano has been celebrating the 50-year anniversary on social media by posting old pictures and stories. The song has appeared on Billboard magazine's Hot 100 list repeatedly over the years. It became one of the most played and recorded Christmas songs around the world. The song was part of his 1970 self-titled holiday album, later renamed Feliz Navidad. He said he wanted to do a song that, in his words, really told the story of the Savior's birth in a way that was musical and people could get behind it. The 75-year-old Puerto Rican singer-songwriter has been blind since birth. A documentary film about Feliciano's life is expected to be released next year. Behind This Guitar tells about his path from poverty in Puerto Rico and New York to performing at the Vatican's Christmas celebration. Feliciano said he dealt with difficult conditions in his life. I came from a foreign land. I had no vision, or at least I thought I didn't, until I found out that I did have a vision and that I saw things the way they should be seen. Feliciano will hold a December 20th show featuring Feliz Navidad and other Christmas songs, live streamed from his home.
Today, we answer a question from Adriana in Uruguay. Hi, I would like to know tips on how to choose affirmative or negative sentences while using nothing, no one, or nobody, or anything, anyone, or anybody. I sometimes make mistakes with this issue, and thus the sentence can be confusing for the listener. Would you mind clarifying it? Thank you. Dear Adriana, thank you for writing to us. There is a general standard English grammar rule in that you can only have one negative in a sentence. However, local speech around the country does not always observe that rule. With that in mind, we see that anything is a word English speakers use to express a thing of any kind, in a question or a negative statement. Here are examples of both.
Do they have anything to eat?
They do not have anything to eat.
Remember, the negative statement can only have one negative, and here it is the word not. This works the same way with the other words you asked about, anyone and anybody. For example,
has anyone come to pick up the mail today?
I have not seen anyone this morning.
The negative answer uses not and anyone. You can also add never to make a negative statement, as in,
they never found anybody to do that job.
Now, let us look at the negative forms. Nothing, nobody, and no one. We use these to talk about an absence or lack of a thing or a person. The verb form that appears with these words is always singular, because you cannot have more than one of nothing. Starting with nothing, you can apply our rule again to create a statement with only one negative. Here is how we can use anything and nothing together.
Is anything happening at your school today?
There is nothing happening at school. Today is a holiday.
We can use nobody in the same way, in answer to a question that uses anybody.
Did anybody help you write the letter?
Nobody helped me. I did it all by myself.
Here are two simple rules. 1. Use anything and other words with any in questions and statements that include not or no. 2. Use nothing and the like in statements where there is no other negative word. I hope that helps to answer your question, Adriana. And that's Ask a Teacher. What question do you have about American English? Send us an email at learningenglish@voanews.com. I'm Jill Robbins.
Are you at risk of getting seriously ill from the new coronavirus? Here are some things to keep in mind. 80% of coronavirus cases are mild. Young and healthy people are at low risk. Other people and those with serious health conditions have a greater risk of serious illness or even death. If you have a cough, fever, and difficulty breathing, contact the doctor and stay away from other people. For more information, visit the World Health Organization website at www.who.int or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov. www.cdc.gov.
Now, the weekly program, American Stories. Our story today is called The Californian's Tale. It was written by Mark Twain. Here is Shep O'Neill with the story.
When I was young, I went looking for gold in California. I never found enough to make me rich, but I did discover a beautiful part of the country. It was called the Stanislaus. The Stanislaus was like heaven on earth. It had bright green hills and deep forests where soft winds touched the trees. Other men, also looking for gold, had reached the Stanislaus Hills of California many years before I did. They had built a town in the valley with sidewalks and stores, banks and schools. They had also built pretty little houses for their families. At first, they found a lot of gold in the Stanislaus Hills. But their good luck did not last. After a few years, the gold disappeared. By the time I reached the Stanislaus, all the people were gone too. Grass now grew in the streets, and the little houses were covered by wild rose bushes. Only the sound of insects filled the air as I walked through the empty town that summer day so long ago. Then I realized I was not alone after all. A man was smiling at me as he stood in front of one of the little houses. This house was not covered by wild rose bushes. A nice little garden in front of the house was full of blue and yellow flowers. White curtains hung from the windows and floated in the soft summer wind. Still smiling, the man opened the door of his house and motioned to me. I went inside and could not believe my eyes. I had been living for weeks in rough mining camps with other gold miners. We slept on the hard ground, ate canned beans from cold metal plates, and spent our days in the difficult search for gold. Here in this little house, my spirit seemed to come to life again. I saw a bright rug on the shining wooden floor. Pictures hung all around the room, and on little tables there were seashells, books, and china vases full of flowers. A woman had made this house into a home. The pleasure I felt in my heart must have shone on my face. The man read my thoughts. "Yes," he smiled, "it is all her work. Everything in this room has felt the touch of her hand." One of the pictures on the wall was not hanging straight. He noticed it and went to fix it. He stepped back several times to make sure the picture was really straight. Then he gave it a gentle touch with his hand. "She always does that," he explained to me. "It is like the finishing pat a mother gives her child's hair after she has brushed it. I have seen her fix all these things so often that I can do it just the way she does. I don't know why I do it. I just do it." As he talked, I realized there was something in this room that he wanted me to discover. I looked around. When my eyes reached a corner of the room near the fireplace, he broke into a happy laugh and rubbed his hands together. "That's it," he cried out. "You have found it. I knew you would. It is her picture." I went to a little black shelf that held a small picture of the most beautiful woman I had ever seen. There was a sweetness and softness in the woman's expression that I had never seen before. The man took the picture from my hands and stared at it. She was 19 on her last birthday. That was the day we were married. When you see her, oh, just wait until you meet her. "Where is she now?" I asked. "Oh, she is away," the man sighed, putting the picture back on the little black shelf. "She went to visit her parents. They live 40 or 50 miles from here. She has been gone 2 weeks today." "When will she be back?" I asked. "Well, this is Wednesday," he said slowly. "She will be back on Saturday, in the evening." I felt a sharp sense of regret. "I am sorry, because I will be gone by then," I said. "Gone? No, why should you go? Don't go. She will be so sorry. You see, she likes to have people come and stay with us." "No, I really must leave," I said firmly. He picked up her picture and held it before my eyes. "Here," he said. "Now you tell her to her face that you could have stayed to meet her and you would not." Something made me change my mind as I looked at the picture for a second time. I decided to stay. The man told me his name was Henry. That night, Henry and I talked about many different things, but mainly about her. The next day passed quietly. Thursday evening, we had a visitor. He was a big, gray-haired miner named Tom. "I just came for a few minutes to ask when she's coming home," he explained. "Is there any news?" "Oh, yes," the man replied. "I got a letter. Would you like to hear it?" He took a yellowed letter out of his shirt pocket and read it to us. It was full of loving messages to him and to other people, their close friends and neighbors. When the man finished reading it, he looked at his friend. "Oh, no, you are doing it again, Tom. You always cry when I read a letter from her. I'm going to tell her this time." "No, you must not do that, Henry," the gray-haired miner said. "I am getting old, and any little sorrow makes me cry. I really was hoping she would be here tonight." The next day, Friday, another old miner came to visit. He asked to hear the letter. The message in it made him cry, too. "We all miss her so much," he said. Saturday finally came. I found I was looking at my watch very often. Henry noticed this. "You don't think something has happened to her, do you?" he asked me. I smiled and said that I was sure she was just fine. But he did not seem satisfied. I was glad to see his two friends, Tom and Joe, coming down the road as the sun began to set. The old miners were carrying guitars. They also brought flowers and a bottle of whiskey. They put the flowers in vases and began to play some fast and lively songs on their guitars. Henry's friends kept giving him glasses of whiskey, which they made him drink. When I reached for one of the two glasses left on the table, Tom stopped my arm. "Drop that glass and take the other one," he whispered. He gave the remaining glass of whiskey to Henry just as the clock began to strike midnight. Henry emptied the glass. His face grew whiter and whiter. "Boys," he said, "I am feeling sick. I want to lie down." Henry was asleep almost before the words were out of his mouth. In a moment, his two friends had picked him up and carried him into the bedroom. They closed the door and came back. They seemed to be getting ready to leave, so I said, "Please don't go, gentlemen. She will not know me. I am a stranger to her." They looked at each other. "His wife has been dead for 19 years, Tom said. "Dead?" I whispered. "Dead or worse," he said. "She went to see her parents about 6 months after she got married. On her way back, on a Saturday evening in June, when she was almost here, the Indians captured her. No one ever saw her again. Henry lost his mind. He thinks she is still alive. When June comes, he thinks she has gone on her trip to see her parents. Then he begins to wait for her to come back. He gets out that old letter, and we come around to visit so he can read it to us. On the Saturday night she is supposed to come home, we come here to be with him. We put a sleeping drug in his drink so he will sleep through the night. Then he is all right for another year." Joe picked up his hat and his guitar. "We have done this every June for 19 years, he said. "The first year there were 27 of us. Now just the two of us are left." He opened the door of the pretty little house, and the two old men disappeared into the darkness of the Stanislau.
You have just heard the story, The Californian's Tale. It was written by Mark Twain. Your storyteller was Shep O'Neill. This is Shirley Griffith.
And that's our show. But we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place, with another Learning English program on the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Katie Weaver.